Welcome to the Feed Central Hay Matters podcast, your go-to source for all things hay-related in Australia. I'm your host, John Paul Driver. In today's episode, we're joined by Alan Ratty. Dr. Alan Ratty is Intergrain's national oat breeder. Before joining in 2018, Alan worked with Dow AgriSciences as the lead wheat breeder in Australia, where he oversaw the company's national plant breeding structure and science. He was also accountable for Dow's Southern Breeding Node, the Australian Wheat Breeding Program. Welcome to the podcast.
Good morning in Australia. Good afternoon to you, John Paul, over there.
Yeah.
Great to be on board with you.
How did you get started into plant breeding? We'll start with a little bit about you.
So, yeah, thanks. It's a really interesting question. I grew up on a farm. I grew up on a dairy farm where fodder feed was crucial to what we did, of course. Little country town called Mergen, not too far from Toowoomba, and Feed Central head office. And, you know, it was one of those things. I was always keen to be involved with agriculture, and I realised very early on that the family farm wasn't big enough for two. You know, I had an older brother, so he was always going to win that race. And I thought, okay, I want to stay in agriculture. You know, you need three things to live, right? You need feed, you need food, water, and air. And how do I have an impact in any of those things? I can impact feed, making sure that people have got food to eat. And so, you know, as a plant breeder, I don't want to sound like I'm patting myself on the back here, but, you know, we do have a tiny impact in that whole scheme, and that makes me feel really good. There's a lot of challenges in what we do. There's a lot of long hours. There's a lot of occasions where you basically feel like a farmer because you're working, you know, sun up to sundown, and then you go back to your hotel room and you keep plugging away with numbers and stuff, but you're doing that because you want to make sure that there's plentiful options out there for farmers to grow more food for the world.
You mentioned numbers, and I didn't finish your introduction here. You hold a Bachelor of Science and a PhD in quantitative genetics from the University of Queensland. What's quantitative genetics?
Quantitative genetics, it's a really fancy way of just saying that we can measure a lot of stuff in a lot of different environments at the same time with a high level of accuracy. That's, you know, it's basically quantitative is just measurable. And, yeah, so we spend a lot of time understanding the measurable differences between parents, between progeny of parents. And then as we get into genomics, we spend a lot of time in understanding how that all leads through as well. There is a lot of science in the background of what we do. Don't get me wrong. And as we specialize into different areas of, you know, quantitative genetics and biometrics or statistics, whatever you want to call it, and then genomics and then pathology. And then there's, across all of this, we also have to do chemistry. Because we not only do you want to have the most product, you've got to make sure that product is valuable. So you've got to understand the chemical composition of the product that you were working with. So there's a lot of elements to being a plant breeder. And I think the tree breeder who got me first excited about being a plant breeder was he described the plant breeder basically as an orchestra. You know, you're the expert in none of the instruments. You don't quite know how to make the trumpet work perfectly, et cetera, et cetera, but you know how to blend them all and how to optimize this one up and down to get the best result. So, yeah, that's where I think that's the most exciting part about being the plant breeder.
You just equated fiber digestibility and plant height to a tuba and a trombone.
Yeah, yep. And they're all just elements. They're all just part of the package. We always have to breed a package that goes across, you know, 20, 30, 50 traits, depending on what's valuable and what's not. And every little bit plays its part in the orchestra.
Yep. Now, I do want to get to your modern goals, but I want to talk about how you moved from sugarcane to wheat to you've done work in corn and soybeans and now oats. What did that progression look like? And what are the similarities and what are the differences?
Sugarcane was a really good place to start because it was such a messy genome that, you know, you actually had a lot of time to understand the basics of quantitative genetics. So you'd spend a lot of time early on understanding, you know, the theory of quantitative genetics and the impact of selection and the average effect of gene substitution, all those really things that Gregor Mendel was talking about in the 1800s. And and how you then basically just scale it up and then scale that up and then scale that up. You know, the time in Dow was amazing because, you know, I got to see what was going on in, you know, corn and soy, the big crops, especially corn. And, you know, you got to rub shoulders with those people who were eminent scientists. And, yeah, that was amazing. But then it all came back to the fact that you could have a discussion around the table and you'd have these you know, heads of department overseeing, you know, hundreds of US million dollars worth of research. But when it actually came down to it, you just had to remember your basic quantitative genetics and how to apply those sort of things. And so that was amazing for me. And so, you know, and it was just striking how we could just have a discussion, you know, regardless of your title, basically. And it was really eye-opening. Sugarcane was a really great crop to work in Enciro. Spent a lot of time there working in traits and pre-breeding, as we call it. You're trying to understand what the individual traits have. For example, we spent a lot of time working on dwarfing genes in wheat and how that would actually impact on, you know, above and below ground growth and what that meant for farmers in a situation where they had moisture, at, you know, in first week of April, they could sow into if they could sow it at, you know, 6 inches or 150 centimetres, but they couldn't if they could sell it at, you know, 50 mil. So, you know, there's a lot of differences there that we work through, and decomposing the plant from a physiological viewpoint and understanding how trait by traits interact is amazing science as well. And I was listening to Sabrina Greenwood, who was one of your episodes a little while back, and, you know, what she's talking about there of 2050 ag, like, yeah, that's exciting. And I've been a part of that journey very early on in CSRO, and I think that's why in plant breeding, you know, there's always a need for continuous improvement in plant genetics in adaptation to stress. And as, you know, Sabrina was talking about, you know, there's the all the risks coming through with climate change and understanding how you can tap individual parts of that system to improve and breed for adaptation to each one individually, but hopefully breed holistically across all the traits that are diseased and where the stresses that are coming.
That's going back to that orchestra idea, all of that variety of traits.
Correct. Everything is connected. And if it's not connected, if you do something in isolation, it's a data island and you can't connect it, and it's not a waste of resource, don't get me wrong, but it's an inefficient use of resource. So we spend a lot of time in resource optimization as well.
You're looking for the similarities in processes, the similarities in techniques for breeding oats that are very, very similar to what you would have used in wheat or sugarcane.
Correct. All of the quantitative genetic theory holds. There's a few nuances around, you know, between species. Barley, for example, has got a small genome, so it's pretty simple. You got one copy of every allele, whereas for every gene, you know, for wheat and oats, you got three. You know, that makes it a bit harder, of course, because it's a hexaploid. Barley's a diploid. You know, corn is the easiest, of course, because it's small and it is a diploid. Don't tell any corn breeder that it's easy, of course.
I've recently thrown some rocks at our alfalfa breeding, or lucerne breeding programs in the States. Our corn yield has traditionally increased about 1.9% per year, while our alfalfa yield is actually flatlining. We had some good discussions around what might be causing some of those things. The real answer is we're running out of water in the West, so we're growing less alfalfa on irrigated acres, and there's more dryland production that's dragging our national yield. But the point still stands. We're not.
Yes,
some
yes.
crops are harder to make those consistent gains than others.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, the genetically, the simpler the crop, then the easier it is to make gain, of course. But, you know, oats and wheat are big crops. Big genomes. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're talking, you know, 12, 15 gigabytes, you know. Barley's, you know, two or three. I think corn's about the same. So, you know, that makes a difference. I'm not sure what alfalfa is, sorry. But I know that alfalfa is also a tetra. Is it a tetra or a hexa? I can't remember. It's definitely got multiple copies.
This is where I say I'm an economist, and my knowledge on plant breeding is quite shallow.
Yeah, so, you know, and obviously corn's got some lot of advantages going forward as well around investment. And I think that's one thing that, you know, we need to just keep understanding is, you know, investment drives innovation. It doesn't matter what part of the value chain you're in, you know, if no one's investing in your part of the value chain, you're going to fall down. And if one part of the value chain falls down, then the whole value chain starts to fall apart. So, yeah, there's a few tricks to that. We've got to always make sure there's investment coming.
So, do we want to talk about investment in oat breeding, or do we want to talk about the value, the traits that we're looking for today first? Because those two things are very interrelated.
Exactly. And it's the chicken and an egg story. Just putting it out there, the chicken came first, in my opinion. But anyway, that's a different story. And so for me, the chicken is actually the traits. You know, what's the target? You know, because if you don't have a clearly defined breeding target, then it's impossible to make gain, and it's impossible to therefore attract innovation. And investment for that innovation. So, you know, I when I presented at AFIR at 2023 when you were in
Yeah,
town,
I was there.
John, yeah, I spoke about you know, genetic gain in a public breeding program versus a private breeding program, and you know, the traditions in Australia and copied around the world are normally that, you know, private breeding will go faster, you know, normally around two times the rate of genetic gain per year than a public breeding program. And the major reason for that really is just scale. Like, we're just, you know, we're just bigger, we're more streamlined, you know, we have more mechanics, you know, we have more robots in the systems because we're running big programs. You know, we can afford to have better toys. Let's just leave it at that. You know, one of the things that we've got here at Intergrain, for example, yeah, because we breed wheat, barley, and oats. We're Australia's dominant barley breeding program. We've probably got about two-thirds, 70% of the market share in barley. We're probably about 20% of the wheat market share in Australia. That's coming second, but hoping to go forwards in that area as well. But, you know, because we've got, you know, a lot of plots, we have a robot seed packer that works 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week when we need it to. It doesn't stop for morning tea. It doesn't stop for lunch. It doesn't complain when it's hot or cold. It just keeps going, and it'll pack more plots in an hour than a person would in a day. You know, when you're running 24/7, it really speeds up the process and lets us drive scale. When I was in CSIRO, we used to talk a lot about with the pre-breeding people that, you know, like that Sabrina was talking about. And I'd say, I'd always be that person pushing that, okay, that's really good. That's really exciting technology, and you're getting some great information. How do we do that 10 times faster? And then once we get that working, how do we make that 10 times faster again? Because that's the scale you need to be able to leverage, you know, something from the pre-breeding, the public space, to the commercial reality, and make sure those investments that have been made pre-breeding actually come to fruition in the real world, which is real world as farmers' paddocks always. So, you know, chicken and egg, back to that. The chicken, what comes first is always understanding the value of the product. There's a lot of science that goes behind, you know, understanding how you get to that value, but that's the primary driver. Do you have a product that's valuable or not?
What are those valuable characteristics that you're breeding for today?
So our major focus in oat and hay, in particular, really is around, firstly, biomass. So we just need more of the crop.
Tons. We get paid based on tons.
Yeah. And, you know, quality is important, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if you have a 20% yield biomass improvement for a 2%, you know, premium decrease, then it pays for itself, right? So, you know, it's pure economics. And I think there's a certain element of what happened previous to Intergrain joining the program, where there was a lack of clarity of understanding the true target. And so, one of the things that private breeding always does is we listen to everybody, but then we go, okay, that's all great, but in the end, who's the most important voices we've got to listen to, and how do we make that economically work for everybody in this mix? And we will always breed and select for lines that have got specific adaptation that, for example, are high quality but low biomass, because quality and biomass or yield are always negatively correlated. It doesn't matter what crop you're working in. You go up in one, you go down the other. You know, usually it's protein. You know, you go up in corn yield, you go down in protein of that grain. It's pretty simple, because you've only got a certain amount of resources that you can chuck into the crop. And so, you know, there's a lot of little levers to that. You know, in making sure that you've got that breeding target you know, very clear front and centre is interesting. Another analogy that I use on occasions with when I talk about breeding targets is, you know, the breeding target is the Titanic. You know, we're going along, and you know, we can change direction, don't get me wrong, but it does take us a while to change the whole Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
If we see an iceberg, we can chuck out some life rafts and make sure that we get some products out there. You know, and that analogy really comes back to saying, okay, there's a specialty target over there. You know, it might be a very high quality. Growers are happy to accept lower biomass, but they want it to be very high quality. So they might want it to be very high sugar or high protein or very low neutral detergent fiber, NDF. They mm-hmm. might want something like that. So we'll be able to find that if we know what we're looking for and we understand the value proposition of what that means and therefore the opportunity cost of us either providing it or not providing it. And going back to the fact that, you know, the reason why there's so many people involved in plant breeding is there's a lot of challenges in agriculture. We just need to make sure that farmers have got lots of tools available that work in their farming system.
Maybe this is an oversimplification, but this is how, if you're buying a forage product, you have to think about a couple of buckets. Protein's one, fiber digestibility, and sugar. Those are the three big buckets in my mind. Now, I'm a Timothy grass grower, and I happen to know for a fact that it's not a protein product. I was just looking at a forage test for my Timothy grass, and it was 8.1% protein. And I'm actually really happy with that. I was also happy with the 47% NDF, which actually is really high, but the DNDF, the digestible portion of that, was 55%. So we're talking about highly digestible forages, and then the sugar on it was 16%. These are universal numbers, right? That almost sounds
pretty
like
good number, yeah.
Yeah, that almost sounds like an oat and hay crop, right? As I think about the forage product that that hay field has gone to Japan in the past. It didn't this year, but in past years it has. So we're participating in the same markets as Australian oat and hay producers, in the same export markets anyway. As you're thinking about the products that you're breeding today for the future, there's going to be an interplay between drought tolerance, biomass quantity, the tonnage, and then those other three things that I talked about, the protein, the fiber digestibility, and the sugar. Can you take me through the interactions? I mean, those are the big buckets. How do you balance those things in your mind?
So that's a great question. Thanks, John. And I think the first thing is how you select for those traits.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got genetic variation, is genetic variation bigger than environmental variation? So if we drill all the way down to it, but at the highest level, we need to be able to make sure we can discriminate or select. Biomass is challenging to do. You know, traditionally we've done it by hand. Now we're in a situation where with some research connections that we've got through AgriFutures, who's a funding organisation mm-hmm. in Australia.
Yes.
So they've got investments in with some of the phenomic centres. There's a really good node, Australian Plant Breeding, Australian Phenomics, APPN is the acronym, Australian Plant Phenomic Network. There's a couple of nodes that I'm working with at the moment, one in Queensland at UQ, one at University of Adelaide in particular, doing a lot of work there. So we're now using LIDAR combined with hyperspec and hyperspectral analysis, and then where you've got the cutback version, and then you've got the full version that you strap on someone's back.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about, you know, needing the sun. So that's the person who goes out and, you know, does the hard work. Everyone else just stands around and watches a drone fly and go, look at how clever we are. But the trick there is that, you know, we're now talking about, you know, being able to get rid of the bottom half or the bottom two-thirds for biomass.
Quicker.
So it, quicker.
That's about the speed of the breeding program, right?
Correct. And the scale. And you can't have scale without speed. And there's a in quantitative genetic theory, there's a formula that was developed, you know, I'm going to say probably 150 years ago around genetic gain equals three things divided by one thing. The three things at the top are selection accuracy, genetic variance, which is size, scale, and repeatability, and then it's all divided by time. Now, obviously, time, you need to also, if you're an economist, you need to put dollars into that.
Time,
money,
value, money, absolutely.
The biggest thing in time is actually is how long it takes. So if you can cut a year out of the breeding program, you know, instead of dividing all those things at the top by 15 or 12, which is what happened previously, dividing by 8, bang, you've just gone forward huge, right? So by us being able to go, this is the bottom two-thirds, we're getting rid of it this year, means that we can actually, instead of starting with a couple hundred lines, we can start with, you know, 5,000 lines. And the chances of us finding that literal needle in the haystack, which is the...
hey jokes.
Which is the... yeah, kind of like dad jokes that never get old.
Yeah.
Finding that needle in the haystack, you know, that very high biomass line that also has got good, you know, acceptable protein digestibility and sugar, becomes greater. And that's what we're about at Integrain. So, you know, the investments we've made in this technology, you know, through AgriFutures and the APPN at the University of Adelaide, you know, it's going to change how we're doing it. We've at Integrain, we've been doing it for the last few years, but our accuracies are not as good, so we're able to get rid of the bottom third. But now, getting rid of the bottom two thirds, it's just a game changer.
How new is that technology? That particular application of that technology.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. I mean, LiDAR, that's kind of how, you know, Tesla started out with this, with the self-drive automation. Mm-hmm. But the hyperspectral analysis, that's been around for a while as well, but it's actually understanding how to put a drone up at, you know, 60 metres and find the plot that's, you know, 4 metres long by a metre wide. That was the challenge. And then how to turn all those pretty pictures into numbers. Like I don't get me wrong, I like looking at numbers, but I much prefer looking at numbers. I like looking at pictures,
but the numbers actually tell the story. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the quantitative part, right? You need to understand that. So, you know, once you start getting numbers, that's great. And so now that we've got what's called feature extraction technology, you know, pipelines where it turns these pretty pictures into numbers overnight, it just changes everything. So yeah, the next step there, of course, is making sure that we can, you know, tap into satellite imagery from, like, you know, the planet satellite, for example. They've got a leaf imagery service, you know, and they'll do some of these traits as well on a bigger scale. It's bigger than what we can handle at the moment in our breeding situation, but you know, it's something to think about in, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 years time, that to taking it to the next level and letting growers be able to say, you know what, this is a high value paddock and this is a low value paddock.
I mean, that leads to economic returns, right? I have conversations with growers all the time about knowing your financial numbers. In this exact instance, we're talking about the same things, which paddocks are making you money and which ones aren't. And correct. Then how do you change it?
Yeah, and well, can you change it? Is another part of that question, of course, but can you change it? So back to your question around the quality. Once you've got biomass, you know, now that we're working through biomass, the next thing is to work through with quality. The really exciting part about these hyperspectral technologies that we're using, so these are shooting, the one from the drone shoots, you know, 400 to 1,000 nanometers at the crop. One from the backpack does 400 to 2,500 nanometers. And so we're able to start to get a really good digital representation of the plant.
That's the wavelength of the light that's being shot at the plant.
Hitting it, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then rebounding back, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it shoots it and it rebounds back, yeah. And the really exciting part now is that if we're starting to get some accuracies for WSC that are attractive, and, you know, and meaning that we can actually start to understand, is this a high WSC crop or a low WSC crop?
It's that same selection process, right? Biomass correct. First,
yep.
sugar second is what you just told me.
The second.
Okay.
Yeah. And sugar will be related to fiber digestibility. It's highly related to starting fiber, NDF and ADF.
Really?
Not highly related, but it's related.
It's related. Sure. Positively correlated is what you're saying.
Well, it's negatively correlated.
Oh, negatively. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And but you want a low NDF. You want a low fiber anyway, right? So that's good.
Yes.
So it's kind of positive, but it's actually technically a negative correlation.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a positive negative, if that makes sense.
it's a good yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're trying to skin multiple cats at the same time, effectively. So yeah, and this technology starts to mean we can have a multi-layered approach and attack many of the traits simultaneously, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, I have a background in econometrics and multivariate regression. This is what you're doing.
Correct.
I know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, so in the end, once we start to get all this working in the field situation, then we can start to, once we have a phenotype that we can select for, then we can start to do the genomics. And, yeah, so we're now, we've got a small investment from AgriFutures in genomics that's going to also leverage a lot of dollars that we're putting in at Intergrain into genomics. And Intergrain in wheat and barley, we've developed one of the premium freely available chips. There is SNP chips, which is just a genomic term, that are used by, you know, USDA, for example. You would use it as well in wheat and barley. And so we've done that in collaboration with AgVic Research there in Melbourne. And so we'll apply the same attributes in oats. When I was in Saskatoon, I was talking to a couple of the US people there and the Ag Canada guys there, and we're all keen to sort of see if we can start to build a bit more genomics globally using that same sort of technology. And again, it's crop agnostic. It doesn't really matter. It's, you know, the technology's the same, which is the great thing about crops, you know. And it's, and you know, animals are the same. They're just a whole different species, if you know what I mean. But yeah, it's the same.
Well, as you were talking about your rapid selection processes, I was thinking about the genomic testing they're doing on dairy heifers now. The rate that they can test heifers and get them into a breeding program is it's just staggering. Absolutely staggering.
It is, and we're in a situation there that, you know, in wheat and barley at Intergrain, that we can now basically say, okay, this is going to be a good variety. You know, categorize 1, 2, 3. It's going to be good. It's going to be really good. It's going to be average, or it's going to be bad. And we can do that just from DNA, and we can do that much earlier than we used to. And you can skip a couple of years of the breeding process, the selection process. Yeah, you think about the genetic game formula, that's just the attacking that bottom layer of time. You do it faster, and because it's actually more accurate and effectively cheaper to do it in silico, in situ, in DNA, you can actually drive up the top because you just have bigger numbers. Full scale. Scale and doing it faster. Bigger and faster.
Bigger and faster. Now, Norman Borlaug is perhaps the most famous plant breeder. And we were talking about those dwarfing characteristics. He was a leader on that in wheat, right?
He was one of the scientists involved in it. What Norman was able to do, develop a system, and I mean, don't get me wrong, great guy. I had a discussion recently with a friend around organic food versus, you know, what we do. There was a few bits and pieces around it. I sort of said, well, maybe the biggest problem that plant breeding has done is enabled there to be, you know, a few more billion people alive in the world without food. You know, and you think about what Norman Borlaug did back then when, you know, in the 50s and in the early 60s when India was an importer of wheat to then being an exporter a few years later. So what Norman Borlaug did a great job of, and we could probably go back live now, is what he did a great job of was understanding how to fast-track all of the technology that was coming, the dwarfing genes, and linking that with agronomy, and then linking that also with disease resistance. So he developed the contra-season nursery between Albertan there at Mexico City, basically, and Obregon.
Yes.
Yep. He had the irrigation at Obregon, and he had lots of skilled workers working with him, and he just fast-tracked everything, increased scale, increased accuracy.
And you went exactly where I wanted you to go. I mean, my understanding, he had a breeding program in the US, he had a breeding program in Mexico, he was carrying those traits back and forth and accelerated his breeding program.
Yep.
Is that happening in your work? Using technology instead?
No, but we actually use both. So what Norman was doing was two generations a year. We now do four. So basically we have speed breeding that we use, you know, in the early phases of the breeding program or selection phase, just to make sure that we can get things genetically fixed as quickly as we possibly can. So, you know, we grow things under light 22 hours a day and constant heat, so that they, instead of being from planting to harvesting, normally taking, you know, in a glasshouse, normally you take, you know, 20 weeks in the field, depending on whether it's winter or summer, it'll take, you know, 20 weeks or 30 weeks. We're now doing it about 10 or 11 weeks. So we're basically just, you know, decreasing the selection, the generation cycle time. So therefore we're getting more generations through in a year, which means, again, thinking of that genetic gain formula, we actually just take time out of the equation, which means genetic gain goes faster.
That's amazing.
And I don't know whether that's the guitar, whether that's the drummer or the guitar, but that's a real key element in that orchestra of just speeding things up. Yeah.
that's increasing the tempo. I get it. The stuff that you're working on today, when will it be commercially available? We're talking about the speed of these breeding programs and the speed of the selection process. That should result in new research hitting the farmers' paddocks faster.
Correct. And if it doesn't hit the farmers' field, we're all wasting our time, right? So, you know, that's what we're all about. And so at Integrain right now, we're trying to understand how to make sure that we can get these new varieties adopted by growers. We've actually got a couple of new products out that are quite exciting and are better than the previous varieties, but it's actually a trick to get growers to take up a new oat and hay variety for two reasons. One, they know what they know and they like what they like and it seems to be working for them, so, you know, maybe they don't need to change. The next thing is you've got to make sure you've got seed available, because the target is actually not grain, it's fodder. So you like what you see, you harvest it, you go, great, that worked perfectly. Oh, wait, I've got no grain left for next year. So
nobody harvested the grain and you have no seed to plant. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a balance there we've got to work through. But, you know, we're definitely working in that space right now. Breeding is a long-term game. And, you know, we talk about, so what's happened previously, they were talking about 12 to 15 years from a cross to release a new variety. We're now aiming for more like, that 9 to 10. The lines that I'm most excited about are the ones that have come through this phenomic, as we call it, the drone phenomic selection. And they're now probably about 2 or 3 years away from being, 3 or 4 years away from being released. We've got a couple of new lines right now that we're excited about. One of them is actually leveraged out of our grain program. So that actually is a really good a good attribute, because it'll actually, growers can therefore de-risk their farming system. They can say, okay, especially if they're in an area where they can deliver oat grain to a mill or to a feedlot, they can say, okay, cool, I'm going to grow this variety, and if it looks like it's going to make a great hay crop, and the hay prices are high, I can cut it for hay. If hay prices are not good, they can take it for grain. So that flexibility, that dual purpose flexibility of oats is quite exciting compared to most of the other cereals and some of the other crops. But we do have a few new lines coming. We are continuing to work with some of the other lines that we've already got around. So Integrain, in partnership with GIA, released two varieties, one called King Bar, one called Archer. And they're the first, or currently the only varieties out there that have got IMI resistance built into the background. So it is a single gene, so integrate by sowing, IBS. But what that means in sort of northern New South Wales, Queensland, where there's a lot of Inovex, imidazoline and chemistry gets put out over summer to control weeds. Now farmers have got another option that they can actually plant one of these imi-tolerant oat varieties into that system. And therefore, again, it's just farmers having systems, tools in that work in their system.
Remind me what that chemistry controls.
I'm actually not that sort of a chemist, but it can control, a lot of grass weeds, and in particular is what it controls. Yeah, brome grass is the main one.
Gotcha. Downy brome, probably. Yeah.
It's a very widely used chemical in agriculture in Australia.
Here too.
And where you have, Flame or Century or, whatever those products are. And what that enables growers to do is now they've got an opportunity, they can plant a crop in the ground in, March, where normally the soil would be just sitting there bare. And if they've got moisture, it's away and they're producing feed that they can either graze or they can take it through to hay, and it just gives them more options.
That flexibility is amazing.
Yeah. In the end, one thing that I've learned over the years and I've been in agriculture for pretty much all my life, is that it's not actually as much as having an upside, it's all about de-risk for farmers and that understanding it's great to have something that's going to be 10% higher yield in a good year, but if it's 20% back in a bad year, you don't want it, because that's too much of a risk.
It increases the volatility in that case.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. We haven't talked a lot about root structures. I'm not too different. The seasonality is different, of course. We're growing our hay through the summer instead of through the winter. But water is our biggest limiting factor, just like it is for most oat and hay producers in Australia. And that access to water has everything to do with the roots. I'd love to hear your thoughts on roots.
Have you ever come across an emu or an ostrich?
Yes.
The ostrich is a great joke where you bury your head in the sand. And unfortunately, that's effectively what we're doing in Oats at the moment directly, because we're actually not assessing roots. What I will say is that above ground biomass is related to below ground root systems. The one thing we know for certain is that the longer the root system is growing for, the bigger it'll be. So, you know, roots grow at roughly a centimetre a day, doesn't matter whether it's wheat, barley or oats. Early oat roots typically grow a little bit faster than wheat and barley, a little bit more vigorous early on. Oats have what's called a mesocotyl as well as a coleoptile, so you can plant oats deeper than wheat and barley. So you can plant oats. So, you know, corn has a mesocotyl as well as a coleoptile, so you can actually plant oats down to, you know, 100 millimetres under soil and, you know, as long as the soil is not too hot, it should come up. Whereas wheat and barley, you can't do that. So there's, having an opportunity, you know, remembering we're in a different season, of course. You know, if you're planting in, you know, March, April, and you've got moisture down there, you can go at it with oats. You can't go at it with wheat and barley because you can't get down that deep in the soil. It's too hot, it won't come through. But, yeah, as far as overall root biomass goes, and a big above-ground crop equals a good root system. That's the learn that I've got from the work I did with CSIRO in wheat, and I'm just applying that at the moment. I do want to go dig up some ground butter and dig up some plots. I really do.
Hmm.
Yeah, and check it out for, yeah.
I did just learn something, because we actually plant our oat crops at the same time as you do. But we're planting Correct. Coming out of our winter, like the 28th of March, maybe, is I think when we planted last year. Now, for us, the snow is just gone.
you're not going deep at all because you're trying to get it shallow so get it out of the ground as quick as possible.
We're trying to do fall tillage before the snow and then get in, get that ground to warm up as much as possible in the spring. And I just thought that was one of the oddities that came to me is we're planting our oat and crops at the exact same time.
It was quite interesting because when I was in Saskatoon, you know, August I was there. And so you know, I planted all of my trials in sort of April into May, and most of their crops were planted around the same time. I left in Australia and nothing was booting yet, you know, that booting phase over there. Everything's, you know, flowered, you know.
It grows different here for sure.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
The longer days here also makes a lot of difference.
Oh, big time, yeah. And it's all about thermal time. And, you know, thermal time is a big player in all of this, and day length plays a big part in thermal time. When you talked before about roots, John, and for me it's a big passion. When I was in CSIRO, a lot of the work that I was doing was around improving water use efficiency. And remembering in Australia we're growing it through winter. And so what we're doing now is, as we shift the sowing window forward a little bit in oats, grain oats in particular, but also in hay oats. So we're sowing more into April than we used to. And what that enables the crop to do, assuming it germinates, of course, is it enables it to get up, and it'll be at the, you know, that pitch you got behind you. It'll be at that growth stage as the weather starts to cool off, right? And so what do we know about water use efficiency? The biggest driver in water use efficiency is exchanging water for carbon, so transpiring. When VPD or vapor pressure deficit is low. When's vapor pressure deficit low? It's lowest in winter. Yeah, usually less wind, lower daytime temperature, lower and higher humidity. So your vapor pressure deficit or VPD is lowest in Australia in winter. And so by altering the sowing window a little bit forward and making sure you've got a crop happily pumping away, you know, growing, transpiring, photosynthesizing, et cetera, in winter, the bigger the crop's going to be, the better water use efficiency it's going to have. So that interface with agronomy and farming systems is crucial.
Oh, absolutely. What's something that you would want growers to know?
I guess the biggest thing that, you know, I want growers to know is that we're working really hard at this. And, it, you know, and I mean, I can talk about, you know, investment and how much money it costs and all that sort of things, but, you know, everyone's spending money, I get that. It's just around making sure that effort is rewarded. And so, you know, in Australia, we have what's called an endpoint royalty system. And so, you know, hopefully growers, you know, are doing the right thing and declaring what they're growing, because that's going to make sure that the investment continues. as you know, Sabrina Green was talking about, you know, as we go into a changing climate, you know, we don't quite know exactly what works now is going to work in 2050. You know, so we're always, breeding will mitigate, you know, we'll have continuous improvement to mitigate those impacts of climate change. You know, it's an expensive game that we all play. Farmers, that can be wrong, spending a lot of money as well. So it's around rewarding the investment and the hard work that's put in. That's one thing. And the next thing is that, please let me know what your targets are. At the moment, you know, I get a lot of people saying different things. Yeah, your clarity around just going crude protein, fiber, digestibility, and sugar, which is effectively what I'm working towards, you know, is great. But understanding the value of those three things versus tons, I guess, is the next part of it.
And what trade-offs you're willing to make.
Yeah, precisely. What trade-offs economically a grower's willing to make. And then the other thing is just logistics. The bigger the crop, right, the harder it is to knock down, to butt, and then to windrow and trail. And it's
drying and windows. And
to be drying. Yep. You know, if you've got a variety that can cure or dry down a day faster, that'd be huge. That would be huge because it's, you know, as soon as you, I don't know what the weather forecasting systems are like in your part of the world, but
equally
over here,
bad.
You know,
equally bad.
You know, we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that we're taking our samples at the correct growth stage, but in the end, and I know this from firsthand, you know, we bail a lot of stuff on my family farm. You know, you're sitting there, you're basically going, okay, it's going to cut this in the next 2 weeks, basically, and you're looking at the weather forecast. When am I going to have, you know, 5-7 days of clear weather? So, you know, understanding how, if there's any genetic variation, and we have got a little project at the moment that we're working with to understand if there's genetic variation in curing time, is something that I think would be quite exciting if we can find it. But yeah, there's understanding that trade-off between tons and quality and how tons impact, you know, the logistics of cutting the crop and getting it in the shed.
So it's the middle of January here, and we just had our middle of winter. We just had our Northwest Hay Expo, and one of the featured presentations was a dairy nutritionist, and she shared with us that she's in charge of feeding about 90,000 animals between milking cows, heifers, calves, and on more than one dairy. It was a very alfalfa lucerne oriented audience, and they spent a lot of time talking about fiber digestibility. And for me, the most important part of that whole conference was growers listening to the actual end user. So I want to ask the actual end user, way down the line from where you're at today, is maybe a Japanese dairyman. Do we have efficient systems to get that information back from a Japanese dairyman?
Yeah, and so all the in Australia, obviously there's, you know, domestic hay and there's export hay, and hay millers, Hay Australia, and those sort of people talk to me quite regularly. And, you know, Gilmack and Balco and Johnson's, and but yeah, you know, they talk to me, and fibre digestibility is one of the key attributes, and there's two components. So one is just making sure that all the energy is being used right. The next part of that becomes actually in a greenhouse gas emission system. Because if you're actually producing biomass that effectively just goes out the back end of a cow, and that fiber is unused, then, you know, it's a greenhouse gas, GHG, inefficient system. So you want to make sure all of that fiber is digestible across, you know, 240 hours. And so, you know, I'd love to have some more research and understanding, you know, how that fiber digestibility changes across time with varieties, and then the impact on greenhouse gas, because sooner or later, when the world has to start paying for carbon, and it was quite interesting when I was in Saskatoon in August for this conference, you know, there were farmers there assuming they're going to get a check from the government for their carbon credits. Whereas over here, we're working on a slightly different assumption. And so, you know, how globally this plays out will be important as well. Don't get me wrong. If one country is working on a different GHG system than another country, that's going to be a big impact. But We all know that it's important. Yeah.
Well,
so greenhouse gases, you know, can all interact with that. Yeah.
What I just learned is we're producing the seed, we're transporting it, growing it, harvesting the crop, processing it, shipping it again, and feeding it. And that might be fed on the other side of the world. And if that fiber isn't usable, we just shipped it all the way across the world to create a pile of manure somewhere else. And the fiber part is not what's valuable for, well, there's a little bit of water holding capacity in that fiber if you apply the manure to a field, but that's not actually the economic value that you're looking for.
Yeah, the more that goes out the back end, the more greenhouse gas efficient it is as well.
So, absolutely.
Because you're putting inputs in to grow the crop, and then, you know, I don't know how much diesel gets used to grow the crop and get it to from, you know, from the Pacific Northwest to Tokyo. It's a lot.
it's a lot, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the reality is maybe on a per unit basis, not very much, but the whole scale of the industry.
It'll add up.
Yeah. I mean, 1 or 2% difference in fiber digestibility could be a lot of greenhouse gas emissions across the whole industry.
Correct. Yeah.
Huh.
Yes. And agriculture is, sorry, but you go.
No, that was just a light bulb coming on over my head. I understand now.
And agriculture is actually, you know, there's a lot of people out there saying that we need to change agriculture because it's such a big emitter. But there's a lot of talk in Europe about that, and they're actually backtracking a little bit now with regards to the policies and procedures. But I think everyone realizes that, you know, you need three things to live, right? You need, one of them is food. So we kind of need agriculture.
I love the research that's going on at Energrain. Mm-hmm. And with all of these things being considered, there's a lot to sort through. So I definitely appreciate the work that you're doing.
And it's, you know, it is always that global connections that we need to build. You know, for example, when I spoke about drones and feature extraction, the first people we worked with there was the University of Purdue.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're on a global platform. Obviously, we act local, but we do think globally, yeah.
Wonderful. I love how everything is so similar, whether we're talking about my Timothy grass or your oats. It's all very similar.
So on fiber digestibility, and I know you guys are using Dairy One, we're trying to use feed test, but we actually do have some reasonable accuracies now for 30, 120, and 240 hours from NIR.
We had some good discussions amongst labs at our Northwest Hay Expo too, and all the labs need competitive differences while still maintaining the integrity of the testing in the industry. You really should be able to take a sample, subdivide it, or rather take that sample, send it off to the lab, ask them for a portion of that sample back and send it to a different lab and get a relatively, like, there's still going to be variability. Don't expect the exact same test result to come back. But it should be close, and that's good and healthy for the industry. But at the same time, then how do the labs compete besides price? So we had some really fascinating discussions around metrics around fiber digestibility, some like the total track NDF, some like just ADF and NDF, some like going to TDN. There's all these different metrics out there, and the labs are trying to differentiate, and the customers have to use that information for it to actually be valuable. I don't have any answers here. It's just a fascinating discussion. Do we use 30 hours or do we use 40 hours? I don't know. 240 hours. I don't know.
Yeah. And actually, on that point, that's where you got to intersect with the animal nutritionist, because at what point does it become irrelevant? Like, you'd assume 240 hours, that's 10 days. Like, me thinking to myself, I'm assuming it's all gone in and it's all gone out within a week at least.
That would be my assumption too, but there's got to be a reason they use 240
hours.
Right.
But the technology that we're using now there was developed by someone who works at the university in an animal lab. So, okay, fine. Obviously, it's 240 hours. It surprises me. But, yeah.
I'm going to say, I don't know.
Yeah, and as soon as we stop learning, we're all in trouble, right? So that's what we get.
But one more point on this fiber digestibility and time. If you're testing 240-hour fiber digestibility, does that mean you have to wait 10 days for your samples to come back? Or do we have a different proxy for that 240-hour digestibility that you can do in 12 or 24 hours? And these are some of the competitive elements of, between labs that were being discussed.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. No, we're always using NIR for all this, and it's built off calibrations. And yeah, so they've got the validate. But
Yeah, but if you do go to the wet chem to really refine those calibrations,
Exactly. Yeah, you need to wait the 240 hours, which is a long time.
Absolutely. Again, I've been joined by Dr. Alan Ratty, and he's Intergrain's National Oat Breeder. Thank you again for your time. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks, John, and thanks to Feed Central for making this opportunity available. Thanks all.
And a big thanks to our guests today for sharing valuable insights. This podcast is proudly presented by Feed Central. Stay tuned in for upcoming episodes.